Okay, so rounding out this unit, so that means that this weekend there's reading exercise due as well as a Canvas assessment. Keep in mind the drop policy as you sort of think about your time and how you want to commit it. The this time of the semester, you know, the these UCEs, the lowest five are dropped, ACEs lowest two, so you might be at the point where if you don't need them, then you don't need to worry about them, and it's totally fine to make use of that drop policy. Group project, make sure you are working with your groups. So there's not, it's awkward, you know, and if I have to get like emails from students saying I haven't heard from my group members and so on. So, you know, make sure you are working with them. Remember, the policy is that if one person or two person or three, you know, have been working on the presentation and there's somebody else that just has not been available, then you can leave their name off the byline or off the kind of the title slide for that presentation. And then I'll do a brief investigation when I see that, but then basically the person who's left off then, you know, will receive zero for a significant portion of their grade, you know, for that. So, you know, make sure that you are involved. Not everybody has to be on camera or whatever for this presentation. We recognize that some people are doing other things, but you have to be contributing somehow. And the way I can tell that you've been contributing is the other group members have put you in that byline. So make sure that you're working with your group. The only deliverable we have left is this presentation upload. So a 10-minute maximum. Don't go over. It's fine to go under. Basically, these videos are going to be arranged like, you know, you're pitching to a stakeholder who you're hoping to get money to fund this experiment. So you're, you know, the, you're, but I mean, that's the overall frame. That's the kind of, that's the how you should structure. It, like you don't, you're not presenting to me, like you're not presenting to the class, you're presenting to a stakeholder who has money and you're trying to convince them to fund your experiment. But for me, like what we're evaluating is, and you can see on the rubric, is do we see evidence that you formed a sensible causal question, sensible hypothesis, an experiment that speaks to that hypothesis in that it makes a prediction based on that hypothesis that allows you to test that hypothesis. And so you would imagine then that your presentation should be structured basically along those lines. So you start out with an introduction that sort of says, you know, this particular system, it raises some questions about, you know, the potential interaction between human activity and this particular animal. And then you know, you can raise that question. So, you know, how does this particular aspect of their behavior work? Then you say, well, you know, there could be, hypothetically speaking, you know, it, this there's a hypothesis that involves that human interaction. So you can list that thing up there. You might list alternatives. Maybe there's an alternative that doesn't involve the human interaction that could explain the behavior. And then you say, and so we're proposing in order to try to understand this, an experiment. And that experiment is, you know, it's going to be run this particular way. You're not actually running the experiment. So the sky's the limit because you're basically imagining yourself asking for resources for this experiment. And then so you specify what the experiment will be, what you would predict under each hypothesis for those for that experiment in order to speak to those hypotheses. And then in your kind of conclusions, you'd say, you know, and if we found these things, it would mean this to the stakeholder. If we found these other things, it would mean this to the stakeholder. So how would you interpret the outcome of the experiment in either way? So that's kind of roughly how I should picture most of these things flowing. Fine to have, you know, images of your animal, fine to you know, it's it, it, there's a bunch of different ways you could structure however the presentation is. Like I said, not everybody has to be, you know, it's not if you've got four people in your group, it's not like you have to split up, you know, 2 minutes each. You know, it's so you can kind of whatever makes sense for the most, the smoothest flow there. So that's what's due middle of the week, the last week of classes. So not next week, Thanksgiving week, but the week after that. And then after that, then everyone will get assigned randomly one presentation to watch. You'll watch that, you know, on your own time, and then fill out a rubric and leave some constructive comments, and then you'll get your peer review credit for that as well. So that's the structure of that final week. We'll have a lecture review on Tuesday. The presentations will be due on Wednesday. Stage one of the final exam will be available Thursday. I'll actually make it available Wednesday through Friday. Then Saturday the peer reviews are due, and then stage two will be available all week, but there'll be somebody staffing the room during that period on, I think it's on Tuesday of finals week. It's on the Canvas calendar in case you want to do the collaborative exams here. Any questions? It's available Monday through Friday, the whole finals week. So this is available Wednesday through Friday. This will be available Monday through Friday during all of finals week. Yeah. All right. Any questions about that? Everybody good? Okay. All right. So we left off last time, talking about sex and the, and mate choice. And so, we mentioned that, in animals, we've got this. I got my pointer back, it looks like. Let me get it back to the right one. There we go. In animals, we've got males and females. We've got, small gamete males and large gamete females, and there are trade-offs there. And so disruptive selection has driven these trade-offs into, so there's trade-offs at the level of how the gametes behave, and that leads to trade-offs in parental investment. And so you end up finding that that these different investment strategies can lead to different criteria for mate choice and different criteria in parenting, and then in both cases, conflict. And so we focused on mate choice last time. We're going to focus on parenting this time. So it's hard to form general rules. So it can vary significantly across taxa. That's why it's behavioral ecology. The ecology really matters. So all of those complex interactions, but we try to at least give ourselves some helpful tools, and that's what we'll talk about this with life history theory that help us kind of figure out, for even if you know a little bit about the background context, what might you predict? So, as examples of how complex things are, it's simply knowing the size of the gamete isn't necessarily enough if the, say, very small sperm comes with a spermatophore that is very costly to make. In which case, now the male investment might have reached the point where it rivals the female investment in making that large egg. In which case, you might see a switch in the behaviors. You might see choosiness move across to the males, for example. So, with greater investment in mating, males are predicted to be choosier and invest more in offspring care, because that's the other thing, is that once they've delivered this spermatophore, then it's now it's it, they can't just forget about it, because they put so much of an investment into it, then it really is a benefit to make sure that it's not a lost investment. So you see behaviors that relate to that, and that gets us to like these pipefish examples. So in here, in seahorse and pipefish, then you get an even in more an even greater investment by the male, where there are pouches, for example, where the eggs can be deposited, and then the male can raise those eggs. But simply knowing that the male raises the eggs doesn't actually tell you everything, because in seahorses, the males raise the eggs, but it doesn't really change things from it, that it turns out the energetic investment is still more with the females. And so it is true the males are raising the eggs, but still the females are slightly more choosier than the males. But things flip for pipefish. And so in pipefish, then you do get a major imbalance between the females and the males, where the males invest a lot more. And that leads to female-female competition and male choosiness, which you see in pipefish, but not over here in the seahorses. So you get these flashy females that compete for these choosy males. So you get pictures like this one, where you've got this this female that has got this big breeding sale, and she is appealing to the male in order to try to mate with the male to deposit eggs with the male. So it's sort of this kind of flipped from what you might expect based on some of the other animals that you know about. So it's complex which one's which, but investment seems to be very much important. That seems to be the tool that we're using to try to predict who's going to be more involved. So that's the kind of idea here, is that we try to use these tools and then do the best we can, but often predicting parental behavior so predicting mating behavior is hard enough, but predicting parental behavior is even more complex. And that's because there's more degrees of freedom, you can get more social groups. It just gets like there's more opportunities for things to be different. So there's more ways in which selection can act on all of those differences. That's what we're getting into today. So a brief summary, how are all of the things that could be different with parental care? Well, you got parents and offspring, but if you think about it across here, how do parents and offspring interact? And not just with each other, like parents and offspring, but within those groups, parent versus parent and offspring versus offspring. And so these are just some of the dimensions on which selection can act. So, there's current versus future offspring. So offspring aren't just competing with offspring that are nearby, but also offspring in the future. If a parent invests in an offspring now, that's maybe less investment in an offspring later. And that, adds that interesting twist. The timing of weaning. So, this general idea of what is the parent investing and how does that conflict with how much investment the offspring would prefer. And that's where you get the investment in offspring, conflict among offspring, both current and future, number of offspring, that's going to be a big thing. So, a parent theoretically, physiologically could have lots of offspring. So why do they not? So those things are going to be coming up here. So the terms that we see over and over, we talk about parental care. So that's, behavior directed to feeding, protecting, in some cases, teaching offspring. And then parental investment. So the care is, we're just saying we're just focusing on the care. The investment is focusing on the trade-off. So when we talk about parental investment, it's about where the returns are. So we say an investment that a parent makes in offspring that reduces the parent's future fitness. So in this case, the parent has a choice. They're saying, I'm going to reduce my future fitness. What does that mean? It means that whatever I do now to help this offspring, it will reduce my ability to help a future offspring or to have a future offspring. So we're focusing here on that trade-off. So if you hold off now on this offspring, it might help you with later offspring. Kind of the idea there. And in order to figure out how parents navigate these trade-offs, we're going to introduce this life history theory where it involves these life history traits. So what are life history traits? They are traits that describe reproductive strategies, such as your age at first reproduction, the number of offspring, and the number of clutches in your animal's lifetime. So we're now not thinking just about what's happening now, but we integrate over the parent's life. And we say, what is their lifetime output? And so that by thinking over their whole life, it gives us a lot better perspective on what they're doing now. Because they might be doing something now which seems crazy. They might be killing their own offspring, and that's going to happen. Or they might be permitting offspring to kill each other, and that's going to happen. But it's only going to make sense from a selective lens if we zoom out and think about what does that mean over the entire life history of the parent's reproductive effort. And that's what we mean by life history traits. Whenever you hear the term life history, you're thinking about at the time scale of the entire life of an animal, not just what's happening right now. So if we think about Tinbergen, we have mechanisms, which are right now, and then we have ontogeny. Ontogeny engages life history. It's that development idea there. So let's get to that. Life history traits and a so-called life history strategy. So you have these traits. Those are the degrees of freedom we're focusing on now, the ways in which selection can act. And what's driving those? Well, there's a life history strategy, which is a suite of these traits that collectively determine the course of life, a shorter lifetime, but larger number of offspring. So it's a way to trade off the things that we talk about up here in order to, with your habitat, with the ecological conditions, to maximize your total fitness over your lifetime. And this is where we engage with these things, R selection and K selection. How many people have heard of R selection and K selection? Some of your other classes, good. So it's a little bit of a review here. So it's this idea that, so this guy Hawling, the same Hawling from Hawling's disk equation, has this thing called the adaptive cycle. And it talks about in all these systems, you start out in your so-called R-selected region. And that R-selected region, you've got lots and lots of resources. You permit lots of diversity. And you get coexistence and things grow and grow and grow. It's a growth region. But eventually, as things grow and grow and grow, they reach a point where they've used up the resources in the area. And at that point, things have to compete for the finite resources that are available. And that's the so-called K-selected. K is, it's actually, it stands for carrying capacity, but in German, that's why we've got K. So R is for reproduction growth. K is for carrying capacity. We're at capacity and you got to fight it out. You could say K is for competition and R is for reproduction. Now, Hawling took this further and said, well, eventually, once you're here, you're going to get so interdependent and so specialized, it'll make you frail. And eventually, you'll have a disturbance to the system, will break it up, and you'll return back to R. So the idea is, if you look over, over the Earth, over the different places in which animals can live, you're going to find different regions being in either the R region or the K region. And so we would expect to see that if there are lots of resources available here, different strategies for the animals that live there, than if there are finite resources available here, different strategies for that. That's, in an essence, in a nutshell, what life history theory is. So over here in the R-selected region, these are unpredictable environments. They're always changing. They're not constrained. So there's sufficient resources so that you can grow and grow and mature and reproduce. You can get fast invasion of new strategies because, again, it's not constrained. New stuff happens and that can take over, or it can coexist with existing strategies, and there's without significant competition. So if you're a parent here, then you just want to produce, growth. You want to say, I'm going to prioritize quantity, not quality. Because here, theoretically, all of your offspring should have a chance. Because in this area, they're not constrained by finding food. There's enough food for everybody. So in that case, to maximize your lifetime fitness, then it's okay to focus on having lots and lots of offspring, because those offspring don't compete with each other. There's no trade-off to having extra offspring. So you just have lots of offspring, and you don't want to spend that much investment on any one of them, because all of them should be able to survive. The background should just be there that they all can survive. So high number of offspring per lifetime, high diversity. It's a bit of a bet hedging strategy, because the diversity there, you say, I'm just going to keep producing diverse offspring, and most likely all of them will survive. But there's no one, like, because it's an uncertain environment, I can't guarantee that one is going to be well adapted. So I may as well just make a diverse number of offspring and then put them out there. And then that way, I'm sure that at least some of them will survive, because something should grow in this area. So that's the idea there. But the trade-off there is that relatively few of these offspring in these diverse groups may actually make it themselves. So you, as a parent, you're just pumping out offspring because you've got enough resources to build these offspring. But now you're pumping out so many of these offspring that it's unlikely that all of them are going to survive to reproduce themselves. So even though there's enough resources for you to build the offspring may not be able to actually make it themselves to this critical point of reproduction. And that's why you pump out these diverse groups of large numbers. This is like what plants do with their seeds. Diverse group of sexually recombined seeds, tons and tons and tons of them. Very few of them will actually germinate. But you pump out a bunch of them and at least some will germinate. And that's the idea here. At least some offspring will survive. So don't focus on any one offspring, because you can't pick which one is going to survive. Just pump out lots of offspring. That's an R-selected parental strategy here. Any questions about that? focus on growth and not long-term investment. So on the flip side of that, you've got K-selected. So now they're stable environments. There really is like an ideal set of, you know, ideal phenotype for this environment. Highly competitive. So if you're not that ideal phenotype, you're not going to survive. And so there's pressure for specialization and efficiency. So less diversity. You should fit the template and you're, there's more interdependence. And so if it's more efficient for you to be, to give up some of your robustness in order to count on something being there, like if, you know, it might be in the R selected, it's unpredictable. So you get more omnivory, for example. So you can eat anything. But over here, it's not unpredictable. They're very stable environments. So if you can grow more quickly by being a diet specialist, then just specialize on that. So you get more interdependence within the group, and that makes every individual in the group more efficient. So what does that do to the parents? Well, theoretically speaking, the parents now should focus on quality. So they should not pump out just a bunch of diverse, arbitrary offspring. They should pump out few numbers of offspring and invest highly in each one of them. So low numbers of offspring, low fecundity, low offspring diversity, specialized offspring with advantages tailored for this highly stable environment. And if you detect that your offspring is not going to survive in this environment, then maybe you stop investing in that offspring and start investing in a new offspring. So the thought is here, you might be less likely to let a struggling offspring survive. Here, you might be less likely to, you might be more likely to only help the struggling offspring. So, because in this case, you want as many of them to survive as possible. In this case, you want to make sure that the right ones survive. So those are the two potential sides of this. And so collectively, this is our life history theory for parenting. So if you can kind of figure out roughly, am I in this type of environment? You would predict roughly these types of traits. And if I am this type of environment, roughly these types of traits. So we're going to see a couple of examples of that. So any questions about this general idea of using life history strategies to help predict parental behavior? Okay. So one example of that is sibling rivalry. So I don't know if anybody's ever gone to the Water Ranch in Gilbert. So it's a all of the golf courses in Phoenix are watered by gray water, which is managed in this artificial riparian they built behind a library in Gilbert. And it's a really nice wetland area. You can go there and a bunch of migratory birds stop over. It's just a great place for looking for birds as they go and filter all this water that then they pump out to all the golf courses. And you can find these elsewhere. You can find these at Kiwanis Park. I mean, there's a lot of water features, but they have coots. You know, lots of these American coots, which are kind of duck-like, but they're not really related to ducks. And cootlings, I guess, I don't know, they're baby coots, have this interesting thing is that the adults do not have much color to them. They're not super diverse. They have kind of a funny quack. The plumage in adults is not very diverse, but the plumage in the baby coots is very diverse. And it appears as if parents pick up on that. And in American coots, the chicks with the brightest plumage grow faster because they receive more food from the parents and they have higher survival rates. So it appears like the brightness of the baby coot is an honest signal of how well it's doing. And as a positive feedback, the parents invest more in the coots that are doing better. So that's an example of sibling rivalry, which acts out. So sibling conflict, where individuals compete for parental care, where in this case, the individuals aren't sort of like fighting for parental care necessarily, but the parents are giving their care based on this physiological signal. So it's, and you know, and that the ones that have less bright plumage, they might die. And so that is an example here of, they're producing lots of offspring and then seeing which offspring is doing well and only supporting those offspring, because you don't know that ahead of time. So you kind of like see how well things are doing. So that's an example of sibling rivalry, which comes through the parent. This also is an example of the so-called insurance egg hypothesis. So a female may have more offspring than can be supported as insurance against mortality within the group of offspring. So it's K-selected, so she really has no business laying more than one egg, but she has two offspring. And she has two offspring because she knows there's going to be diversity in the offspring. So if there's going to be diversity, but if we're in K-selected, we don't want, just super diverse. We need a particular phenotype's going to be well matched for this environment. So have a little bit, one extra, and then early in the development of the offspring, you can figure out which one's better matched to the environment and only then continue investment in that one bird. So this type of, sibling, of abandonment of siblings or offspring is common, it's thought, in K-selected environments. You can't support both. You end up having more than you need because there's always a chance the one you have isn't going to turn out well. So you have a couple and then you support the one that ends up doing better. So insurance egg hypothesis. Okay. So we see that in happen in different ways. So here, this is a blue-footed booby. So these beautiful birds here with these very bright blue feet. It's got these eggs underneath the feet there. The blue-footed booby, and then there are other birds in this, will actually aggressively peck at younger chicks. And so these are the chicks. So before, in the coots, it was the parent that was picking who to invest in. In this case, the parent sits back and lets the chicks fight it out. And older and more well-off chicks aggressively peck at the younger ones, often to the point of killing their siblings. So this is so-called siblicide. So that's an extreme form of sibling rivalry. And so this is another type of kind of honest signal, is that if you develop far enough that are you're strong enough that you can kill the other offspring, then that is a reasonable case that you are well selected for this environment. And this is why they think that in these cases, the adults have not evolved any sort of way of breaking up these fights, because actually, nests where this is going on end up being more productive than nests where it's broken up, because in here, all of the eggs, once you have a winner, you just pick the winner and invest entirely in it. Whereas if you've got a bunch of eggs, a bunch of these insurance eggs, then the extra eggs are kind of wasted investment. And this siblicide prevents that investment from happening. So that's another way that this can happen. So a lot of gruesome stuff happens in these K-selected environments. You really don't want to be near carrying capacity. It's a bad place to be. We've talked about this half of it here. So this was a nice paper that that ends up talking about this across birds. And you think there's this general pattern that in K-selected environments, then you get this parental neglect. So we see here the environmental quality is poor, brood reduction is likely. Parents want to feed the offspring in the best condition, and offspring are selected to signal their quality, to signal which one of them deserves the food. So what happens on the other half of it are selected. And so this paper, is a nice job where they give these examples here where, in R selected, things completely flip. So in an R selected environment, then the environmental quality is good. So it is unlikely the parent is going to kill off any brood. In fact, they're probably going to feed the offspring that has the worst off, because you want to maintain a portfolio of as many offspring as possible. And so offspring then are selected to signal their need. So here they signal their quality, here they signal their need. And so we would expect then to see parents that feed the hungriest here and parents feed the strongest here. And that's the kind of life history prediction there. So yeah, I thought this was from Stuart West and his group. I thought this was kind of a nice summary of life history theory applied to parenting. And there are examples in the birds that go, on both sides of this. Any questions on that? Yeah. Yeah, so that's a good question. So they I think the idea here, I know I said that like these environments are unpredictable. What I think they're using here, and I've had the abstract, I think it would support this, but when they're talking about their use of unpredictable environments has to do with about scarcity, like the fact that over here, you don't know how much food you're going to get. You don't know how many offspring you can support. It's unpredictable as to what sort of nest you can build. And so under that case, you might find neglect because you allow your nest to tell you which birds to feed. And those are the ones that are doing well, and there's a positive feedback. The birds that are doing well gets fed. And so that then leads them to continually neglect the ones who aren't doing well, which leads them to receive even more neglect. So whereas over here, although I was saying these are unpredictable because they sort of have a lot of churn in them, and that was kind of just the standard kind of description of what an R-selected environment is. I think they were sort of saying that, well, yeah, in some ways they're diverse and rich and unpredictable in that way. But really, I think what if you read how they're using this term unpredictable, they would say that, well, in some ways they're unpredictable, but they actually support diversity. And so you can have a diverse set of offspring, and it's very likely with a little bit of help, all of your offspring, despite being so different, will all survive. So I was saying that R selected are unpredictable and that there's no one right set of phenotypes that fit that environment. But I think they're saying unpredictable and that there is sort of a right way to live and you may not track it. Like you may not, like it's more about your offspring are unpredictable and the environment is scarce. So it's more about scarcity. I would have said, if I would have titled this paper, I might say, scarcity leads to the evolution of parental neglect in birds or something like that. We're merging things. Like I try to do my best kind of trying to capture these ideas, but then I also try to pull in resources from others. And, the messages that they give and what I give hopefully overlap most of the time. But in the end, sometimes the frames that we use aren't quite the same shape. So, you guys have to kind of merge that and make the most sense of it. Okay. Any other questions about that? In general, though, regardless of the title, I think this is a really nice spectrum that they have here. These four different criteria and how they correlate with each other. Okay. So we've talked about life history strategy at a snapshot in an individual's life. What is a parent doing right now? But why, it turns out that life history strategy may change over an animal's lifetime. In other words, older organisms invest relatively more in offspring. They act like the environment is more limited than it is. Why do you think older organisms might act like things are more limited? What is more limited with an older organism? What was that? What do you mean by their energy? I think you're on the right track, like that your gut is moving you in the right way, right place. What's different about when you're older and thinking ahead, as opposed to when you're younger and thinking into the future? Do things seem very limited when you're young? Do they seem more limited when you're old? And why? Even the notion of what it means to be old sort of suggests a limit. Less time. That's right. So when you're young, there's plenty, you have virtually unlimited reproductive time. When you're old, this might be your last clutch, your last brood. So what, as a consequence, you often see animals over their lifetime, they shift from a growth phase where they have, lots of opportunity to try new things and to invest in quantity. But then over as they get older, then you would imagine that a strategy that's focused on quantity is not going to be selected for in an older animal, because that a better approach would be to assume that this is the last offspring that you're going to have. And in that case, maybe make sure it survives. So then, I'm just thinking about I was separated by my offspring, by my siblings, by like 15 years. And and they always complain that mom invested so much more in me. And I'm like, well, yeah, it's life history, right? So, Debbie and Kenny, they were down here. They're just experimenting and assuming that they'll survive. But me, I was their baby, their last one. So, then they may as well make sure that that investment was there. And so that's the kind of idea here, is that life history theory can even help us sort of understand why you might get less investment in early offspring and more investment in late offspring. And we do see it in animals. So here's ants versus termites. So you find that many ants, and this isn't actually ant versus termites. There are ant life history shifts and termite life history shifts. So I just happen to grab old termites and young ants. But many ants produce, here's a queen right here, and she has some brood, and there's a bunch of workers here, and the workers are always smaller than the queen, but the first workers are like half the size of the eventual workers. And these are workers called minims, or nanitics. These are the first workers, and the queen can pop them out quick. So these workers don't live very long. She can make a lot of them in a very fast time. So she has just mated. She has just ripped off her wings. She's dug a hole. And at this point, in order for her to survive, she needs to grow. And so she prioritizes growth by producing a bunch of tiny workers that will not live very long, but she can pump out quickly and they can mature quickly, because then they end up digging the colony and building out the colony and creating, developing the colony into that colony's its full extent. And then at that point, she stops laying small workers and she starts laying normal sized workers, and she never ever, for the rest of her life, will ever lay these small workers again. She will invest more in larger workers that live longer and provide her more, more returns in terms of the colony. And this is very similar. If you think of development, there are similar investments in growth. If you think about embryonic development up through, maturity, then you have early investments in growth and then late investments in maintenance. And that's what brings us over to the termites. So termites, there's a similar story that goes on with termites here. Once termites get sufficiently old, then they start producing soldiers. So they're these big, beefy termite soldiers that have these, they have hard cuticles and big, sharp mandibles, and they're good at defending the colony. But it's sort of useless to produce them early in life because you don't have a colony to defend. So now you've invested in defenses, but you don't have a lot of investment in growth. And so it just slows down your ability to build the colony up. And so they don't start producing soldiers until late in life. So it's a shift in reproductive strategy having to do with the age and having to do with what's behind them and what's ahead of them. So, and you do see that in animals, a shift in reproductive strategy. All right, so questions about that idea that life history can change over the age of an animal? Okay. And then, so this isn't exactly a great life history example, but I use it to demonstrate ways in which life history can help us and ways in which that it's you have to be careful about how you're comparing reproductive strategies. And so this is a kind of famous example from Nicotimbrogin herring gulls. So here's a herring gull juvenile. Here's a herring gull adult. There's parent offspring recognition in gulls only after the juvenile gets to the point where it can actually start walking away from the nest. So if you have a herring gull that is too young to walk away from the nest, you can take that herring gull out of the nest of its parent, swap it with another herring gull that is from another nest, and the parent has no idea. We'll just continue to feed the young herring gull. But if you do that same thing with a herring gull that's old enough to walk, then it notices that it won't feed the older herring gull. And so, this, might, make sense then, because, if you think about it like this, from a life history perspective, the adult doesn't have infinite resources. And so it really should only be investing in its own offspring, not the offspring of others. But if the herring gull is too young to walk, it can't be another. Like if it's in front of it, then it must be its own. So it's happy to invest in any young herring gull. But once the gull gets old enough, then it's possible that it's another. So it has evolved the ability to prevent feeding old gulls because that saves that resource. And so it's a little bit of a life history idea here that you're trying to save these resources. But I'm primarily setting it up to contrast with the next gull example from a different species from the same kind of group of birds. But questions about that? Does that make sense that that herring gulls they have parent offspring identification only after the offspring is sufficiently old to walk? That makes sense why that might be. So the parent can recognize that it's that a parent, if a gull is old enough to walk and you place a offspring of that gull in front of it, it will feed it. But if you place another offspring of another gull, something that's unrelated to the parent, it won't feed it. But when they're young enough, it'll feed anything that you put in front of it. But only when they're so young that they can't walk. So once they can walk, then they gain recognition cues that are evident to the parent. So parents cannot recognize young gulls from other young. That's right. So if you have a bunch of gulls that can't walk, then they're kind of stuck in the nest. So it, there's no selective pressure to be able to tell the difference between young gulls because it's costly to be able to tell that. It's costly for one thing. You have to develop a recognition system inside the gull, and that's costly. It takes effort. Maybe it's a bigger brain. There's more resources. You can also make mistakes. So you might, might say, "Oh, this isn't my offspring. This isn't my daughter." But then you end up actually maybe it was a mistake, and it is, and now you're not feeding. So it's costly to get it wrong, and it's costly to build the mechanism to begin with. So it's just, safer if it's if there's a bird in your nest that can't walk, it's got to be yours. Just feed it. That's the safer way to go. But once it can walk, it's a good chance that it could have come from another nest. So it involves that recognition. Now, the interesting thing is there are these other related birds, so they're basically gulls, these kittiwakes that live on cliff edges. Now, these appear to have a different reproductive strategy, but it is not due to a change in life history. It's just to a change in the kind of ecological circumstances here. So these kittiwakes, they live on these cliff edges. So they build a nest on these ledges here. And so, the way these birds, the birds are, they can't walk initially, then they can walk, but they can't fly. And then eventually they can fly, is how this locomotion develops here. So these kittiwakes live on these cliff edges, and they have reduced conflict with predators because they're on these cliff edges, because predators can't get up there. So that's great. But they actually have no ability to recognize their offspring, the offspring of others, at really any age. So the herring gull, once the gull can walk, it recognizes it. But once these gulls can walk, or once these kittiwakes can walk, it still can't recognize their own offspring from others. So you can swap, if you climb these cliffs, you can go and move. You know, if you found a chick that can walk but can't fly, you can move it into another nest and it'll still get fed. So these birds don't have any parent offspring recognition at all. Why? How do? Why do? Why do you think that is? Why haven't they? Why don't they have the need for parent offspring recognition? Right. And that's the idea, is that it's not like you're going to get another, you know, on these cliffs, it's not like you're going to get another one of these off, another one of these chicks that can only walk. It's not going to walk into the nest of another bird. So in that case, don't pay any of the liabilities or the costs of parent offspring recognition. Just feed any chicks in your nest, because it is a very, very, very low probability. It's basically zero that if there's chicks in your nest, they're not yours. And so you can invest in them. So at first, it might look like a change in the lifetime, in the life history here, the life history strategy. But really, it has to do with just the peculiars of the risks of accidentally investing in the wrong bird. So I would say that there's still the same pressure on these birds to only invest in their own offspring, but it because their natural habitat prevents them from accidentally feeding other birds, they didn't have to evolve the offspring recognition. But I would say the life history strategy is probably still the same. It's just it doesn't need parent offspring recognition to implement that life history strategy. So sometimes life history points us in a useful direction. Sometimes, if you notice a difference in parenting, you should step back and say, is it really life history that's happening here? Like, is it, it's, it, you know, in this case, it's not that the kittiwake has unlimited resources, so it'll just feed anything. It's that the kittiwake, it may have limited resources, but it also has very, very low risk. It's going to give those resources to anything but its own offspring. That's why I'm just trying to contrast these two. Any questions on that? Okay. All right. What types of parental care do we get? So now I want to drill down into, like, again, get to the point where we have differences in parental care and conflict. So try to motivate. We've talked about parental care, life history. Now we want to move toward conflict. And we're going to end this session talking about parental and offspring conflict. And that will set us up for our last lecture next week on Tuesday. On basically social behavior. So, parental care, again, I have the definition up here. Under the cases of external fertilization, it creates a lot of opportunities for male care and alloparental care. So parental care by others that are unrelated to the offspring. So this idea of where the eggs are has a lot to do with the types of care strategies that we see in nature. So this is an example of eggs, gelatinous frog eggs, you know, dropped on a leaf. So as an example here is a male so-called midwife toad, and it carries brood on its back. So the female lays her eggs externally. And in this species, then the male is the one that fertilizes the eggs and then carries the eggs around. So the male makes a big investment in these eggs. And so then the male protects the eggs and carries the eggs around with it. And then that's enabled by the fact that we have external fertilization. So we get a lot of very interesting opportunities for different types of parental care just because the eggs get out of the female's body. So it's kind of an interesting consequence there. So that's one thing. Male care, you know, comes up there, and not just male care. Well, then there's male care. So the brood pouches that also evolves there. So if you can drop the eggs off, then you can get transfer of eggs instead of worrying about transfer of sperm. But then you can also get mouth brooding, and mouth brooding will even happen with unrelated females. So this is alloparental care, care by an offspring. Or care of offspring by those that aren't its parents. Gesundheit. So, adoption behavior. So, term here, fry, we refer to fish fry. Those are the very small young hatchling fish. And if you were to look really closely in here, you'd find that this cichlid has a bunch of little fish fry in its mouth. And that protects these fish fry as they develop. While they're mouth brooding, this fish cannot eat. And so, in Usually, when you have social care by mouth brooding, you might even trade the fish. So you might have groups of helpers that trade the fish so that the helpers can eat. And you can get these unrelated females through processes which I think in Bio 436 you talk more about, but you get these groups of unrelated helpers that help to raise the offspring of an unrelated individual, and that ends up paying them off in their own fitness later on in life. But in the short term, they're actually giving up fitness. So it is an investment strategy. They're giving up fitness to rear the brood of another in their own mouths, paying a huge cost because they can't eat while they're doing that. So, and that all is enabled by, things being external to the development happening external here so that you can get not just male care, but even care by others who are unrelated, alloparental care. So mouth brooding of fish fry, example there. A lot of fish, a lot of cichlids in particular have this mouth brooding. Okay. All right. And then external fertilization, you get a lot of examples of uniparental care. So you've talked about a lot. So uniparental care comes in both forms. So the female might have the brood on her back or the male. So this is a different species where she carries the eggs, but I already showed you another, I think, toad where he carries the eggs. So uniparental care is common or can show up in this. Which one is doing the uniparental care? That can vary based on ecological conditions, history, and so on. Now, once you have internal fertilization, then typically if you have uniparental care, it's almost always maternal. And that's just, I think for just logistical reasons. If it has to be fertilized internally, then you're kind of stuck with it until you can get it out. And so that, the really, if the eggs are in the mother and the fertilization has to happen in the mother, then the uniparental care is probably by the mother. So where the eggs are fertilized is a major constraint on parental behavior in animals. Now in mammals, these are a bunch of, we see a lot of maternal care in mammals, likely for this particular reason that, typically the eggs are not going to leave the female. And not only that, not only do you have fertilization happening in or around the female, but usually in mammals, because what's the defining feature of mammals? Milk. And so that resource is something that is only being produced by the female. It's a resource that is needs to be available. And so, particularly when you have these altricial young, so these are helpless at birth, often deaf, blind, and cannot move. They need a lot of resources, and those resources have to be easily available. And so they're probably going to ride around, like in these marsupials, with the female so that she can provide those resources, like this Joey that is nursing inside this pouch of this female. Gesundheit, you have precocial young that can move around. At this point, you don't have a lot of care that goes on out after they're born. And so you don't see a lot of parental care outside of the developmental process. Humans are an interesting case in that we're in between these two. So human babies, they're not quite this, but there's not quite this, but human babies certainly aren't this. They're pretty much useless for many, many years. And so you're stuck with this thing for many, many years. And so, that example here is that, primates are sort of this in between where there needs to be a lot of parental care that happens after the thing is born. And, there are theories as to why, that like the hip structure, for example, of animals that walk upright may not prevent or may prevent having, precocial young. So having young that can pop out fully formed. it may just be impossible to birth those young if you're also walking upright. So there's a bunch of interesting constraints that end up having an effect on the type of parental care that you get. You know, things like where things are fertilized, things like you know, whether you walk upright, all of these things you wouldn't think of necessarily connect to years and years of parental care, all because you're a species that can walk upright. You know, so you know, thoughts about that. But you know, in other animals outside of the mammals, you find a lot of biparental care. And so, you know, burying beetles here. So there's a lot of really fascinating interactions between males and females as they raise their young together. I mentioned, you know, cichlids. There's biparental care that is evolved there. And then there are these birds, like these auklets here. So you find a lot of bird examples where the males are taking care of the nest. Maybe the males are sitting on the eggs and so on. So outside of the mammals, because you don't have to worry about this milk that is only produced by the female, you see a lot more biparental care. Now, in these cases, so a question here is when you have biparental care, like in these cases here, you often see ornamentation of both sexes. Why do you think that is? Why do you think you see pretty males and females when there's biparental care? What do we know about sexual signaling? What is it doing? So, yeah. Yeah, so they might both be signaling their quality as their quality at finding resources and so on. And so the idea here is that if both are investing, then they're both making choices where there might be mate selection going in both directions. So in species with biparental care, you might expect to see choosiness in both sexes. So I think you argue that I think in humans, you know, this is probably more, you know, like I think you see choosiness on both sides of that relationship. And you also see these long-term pair bonds in many, many, many human relationships. Not all, but many. And so that might suggest that that choosiness is, you know, a reason why, you know, males and females don't actually look that different. I mean, they do look different, but it's not quite as extreme as like the grackles that you see out there. The males are these shiny blue grackles and the females are this kind of dull brown. Or in other cases, like the peacock jumping spiders, where the males are really, really bright and the females are dull and brown. When you start seeing ornamentation on both sides, where you almost can't tell the difference between the sexes, but they both look ornamented, that is a good sign that there's probably mate choice by both, which probably means they both are taking, you know, they're both investing in more than just a mating, that they probably both are going to be invested in these offspring. So, okay. Questions about any of that? So, both parents have more of a fitness benefit to ensuring the survival. Now, the interesting thing that I'm about to show here is that, you know, when you imagine both parents are involved in the offspring, that sounds like a happy result. That sounds like a result that's good for everybody, that both parents are involved in the offspring. But that creates a conflict between both parents. This is kind of like never move in with someone just because you want to, like, you know, have lower rent or something like that, or you know, never, you know, like, you know, don't get into a relationship with someone just for, you know, you assume it's going to, like, you're going to have it's just going to make everything easier. You know, oftentimes when you get in relations with other people, it makes things harder because it increases conflict because now you both have a shared resource, but you might want to do different things with that resource. And that's what we see in biparental care, all sorts of new interesting conflicts. And so this is what I'm sort of saying here. There's a fitness benefit to ensuring the survival of their offspring compared to finding the additional mates. So in species that have biparental care, they want to raise the offspring with them. They don't want to go off and find new mates. And that sets up the opportunity for these interesting conflicts. And so, what do we mean by that? Famous example of that is infanticide by males in these lions. So you can have these, you know, these have these male lions who take control of a new pride. So there's a pride, There are these females, there's these offspring cubs there. A male takes control as being the male in that pride. And what will that male lion often do? Will kill all of the existing young cubs to ensure maximal resources for its upcoming offspring. So that is infanticide there. So on one hand, there's biparental care, but it's biparental care of the offspring that are shared among the parents. And the male has evolved this ability to then kill the offspring that are not shared. If I go back to the blue-footed booby males, it's kind of an interesting case. If you take them out of their nest for long enough, like you take them out of their nest and put them back in, they'll take care of the eggs. You take them out of their nest a little bit longer, put them back in, they still take care of the eggs. If you take them out of their nest for sufficiently long, when you put them back in the nest, they kick the eggs out of the nest. And that's, the thought is that if they've left the nest for that long and there's eggs there when they come back, those eggs might be the eggs of another male's. And so they then do the same thing that the lions do, and they kill those eggs. So if we think about the arms race, this is what the males are doing. So what's happening in the females? So one of the things that has evolved in many animals is concealed ovulation. So reproductive strategy by females that reduces the effectiveness of infanticide by making ambiguity over the offspring parent. So if if you can't tell where a female is in the reproductive cycle, it's possible that the infant that she's about to give birth to is the male's. And so that's the idea, is to reduce, to conceal this, to make the maximum ambiguity, to increase the risk that the male's going to kill his own offspring. And in a really weird adaptation, there's this Bruce effect. And there are animals that have this physiological abortion when a new male comes in that is thought to reduce the loss of resources due to future infanticide. So in this case, a pregnant female is in a group when a new male takes over, and her body induces an abortion of the existing developing fetus, in the thought that this has actually a selective advantage because it prevents her raising the fetus to the point of it giving birth, and then giving birth to the thing, and then having it being killed via infanticide. So there's this arms race between the males and females, which is really gruesome. And it all comes down to biparental care and the conflict that happens when you have two parents that are caring for one resource. So it's kind of interesting there. Not, I mean, it's not meant to say that biparental care is always gruesome, but there are these really gruesome examples of these physiological adaptations and behavioral adaptations, and they appear to be due to the conflict that happens in biparental care. Any questions about those? Okay. And then the last thing I want to talk about here, and this will be a nice dovetail, no pun intended, to the lecture we'll talk, the last lecture of the class on social behavior on Tuesday. And so this is the famous example from Trivers, evolutionary biologist, about parent-offspring conflict. And so the thought here is that if we plot on this axis the amount of parental investment, and then we have benefits or costs on this axis, then if we have to think about this in terms of something that we're going to talk about on Tuesday called inclusive fitness. So this is your fitness that comes from your own direct fitness, how many offspring you produce, and how many offspring a relative produces. So there's a chance that the genes in you are in a genes in a relative. So producing a relative, regardless of if it came from you or came from another one of your relatives, provides you some fitness benefit. So if you're thinking in terms of evaluating behavioral strategies in terms of fitness, you have to think about not just what it does to your own direct fitness, but also the fitness of relatives is the kind of idea here in this indirect fitness. And so with that in mind, as the parent increases her investment in the offspring, then she gets a certain fitness benefit, the number of chicks that survive to reproduce themselves. So she experiences this benefit here. Now, if as she invests more in her current offspring, she's effectively investing less in future offspring or other offspring. And so she pays a cost to this investment. And this is the amount of offspring lost. So you can think of this as this is the amount of offspring gained from feeding the offspring. This is the amount of future offspring lost from feeding the offspring. Now, remember that so to any offspring in the nest, they are half related to other offspring in the nest relative to the relatedness from the parent. So she is more related to her offspring than the offspring are to each other. So from the offspring's perspective, you follow a different cost curve. Those future offspring, those do have, there's a good chance those future offspring have genes that are in the current offspring. And so you're going to pay, if you lose out on the future offspring, those genes are going to lose out. But there's less of a chance that your particular genes are in the future offspring's genes relative to what the parent sees. So there's a high chance that the parent is going to have her genes and not dad's genes in the future offspring. But then there's less of a chance that the offspring's genes are shared with the future offspring. So the offspring sees half the cost. So if we got one benefit curve, but these two cost curves, if we maximize the difference between these two curves, we see here that the parent is going to want to feed this much to maximize her benefit, her fitness. But from the offspring's perspective, it's going to want the parent to feed this much. So it's going to want to feed more. And so now we have a conflict between so this is like the milk provided here. So what we might get here is then begging from the the deceptive begging from the offspring here that are trying to get the parent to feed more than in the parent's best interest. This will refer to as parent-offspring conflict, which is a weird thing, and I think that's why Trivers was so interested in it. Is that you would think that your own offspring, like they are your fitness. So you would think that your interests should always be aligned with them. But there is a little bit of parasitism that goes on with offspring. And so, when it comes to offspring and each other, if you have multiple offspring, then you're going to get this, this kind of relates to sibling rivalry. You're going to get here that an offspring is going to want to have it fed more rather than worrying about the future offspring, even though the parent might worry about both offspring just as much. And that's so-called parent-offspring conflict and deceptive begging. So begging and weaning, begging, signaling to induce feeding, weaning the process of removing feeding. And these ones do not want to be weaned early. They want to be weaned later, even though the parent wants to wean them earlier. All right. Dishonest overbegging. Questions about that? We'll talk about that a little bit more in detail about where these curves come from and where this half comes from on Tuesday. Yep. Well, I mean the idea here is it still is they we view it as that's a great question, is that, aren't they hungry because they're being fed here and they need to be fed here. Right. And so it might be they honest, but this conflict, the thought here is it can actually drive overbegging because of that, because this conflict is there, that tension is always there, then rather than you could just beg until you're not hungry. But the thought here is that because this difference exists, then there's always going to be a benefit for the offspring to beg a little bit more because the parent is probably going to land on something a little bit less. And so you get this arms race where you get more begging because the parent, like, how am I going to get this parent to be really responsive? Well, I need to overbeg in order to get the parent to do something against her fitness. Yeah. All right. Any other questions? I'm sure, you know, if you've had a whiny younger sibling or whatever, you know, that's what this is right here. Okay. All right, so covered a lot today. You know, again, like I said, next time is the last new lecture. So then the lecture after that is the review lecture. So we'll talk about social behavior on Tuesday, and then the review lecture on Thursday, or sorry, not on Thursday, on the next Tuesday, because we got Thanksgiving, and then stage one of the exam. So that's the schedule there. Let's the final is, it has to fit within the 75-minute window. It's going to be biased towards the second half. But I mean, we still went, like, a lot of the first half was all foundational. So I'm still going to ask about Tinbergen and things like that. So, but they'll be in the context of topics we've covered in the first half, or sorry, in the second half. I feel like if you know the second half well, you're going to reinforce the first half automatically. All right, so here's hopefully an easy one, multiple choice. All right, so just a little vocab thing. What are fry? Are they immature marsupials? Are they young hatchling fish? Are they unrelated breeding helpers? Or are they food young birds beg for?